Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. And today is December 2nd. Happy December, everyone. It's hard to believe it's December already. Oh, my goodness. But December 2nd, 2016. Now, I don't know what year it is, but it's December 2016. And I'm Julia Cannon. And tonight, I am happy to have as my guest, Ron Chapman. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks, Julia. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. I think we'll just go right into it. I've not been on. Let's see. I think I was off. I don't even know where I am, Ron. That just kind of, you know, this whole thing. I'll just go ahead and tell everybody my microphone. I don't know what was going on. We didn't have sound there for a little bit, and so that just kind of has me all bum fuzzled now. So I'm just I'm all messed up. So these things happen. I guess it's just technology. So, or just the, as mom used to say, the gremlins got in there. So, so how you doing, Ron?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. I'm hanging out in Greenville, South Carolina at the moment. I was over in Charlotte and making my way back to Atlanta, which is where I live. And Greenville's where I'm at for this evening.
Wonderful. Well, what's the weather like over there? Is it cold? Is it nice? What's it doing?
We just had heavy storms go through yesterday. This area, actually Atlanta and Greenville area and Charlotte, all had some trouble with tornadoes, which is kind of weird for the first day of December. But it's cleared out, and we seem to be having perfect fall weather right now.
Oh, super. Whoa, that is wonderful. I think we're supposed to get some storms tonight. It's supposed to start raining tonight and be rainy for the next 5 days is what I was told. So anyway. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and give the call-in number if anybody wants to call in with any questions for our guest tonight. And that's 1-888-627-6008. 1-888-627-6008. And Ron Chapman is one of our authors, and he has, let's see, you've got Seeing True. Let's see, you've got your workbook, and then you have two CD sets with us.
I do.
Let's see, the one is Breathing. Let me get it here. One's about breathing. I've got to get the title of it here. You want to go ahead and tell it?
Sure. Breathing, Releasing, and Breaking Through, Practices for Seeing True. It's a breathwork meditation workshop in a box, as we called it.
Yeah, and it goes with the book. And right?
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that and everything too as we go along.
Yeah.
And then the CD set that just came out very recently, and that's the Way of Spirit.
Right. Yes. I'm tickled you all were interested in bringing it to the market. So thank you, Julia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's get started with the way we love to start, you know, all the shows, because you haven't been on the show in a while.
I have.
So. You know, so for those that don't know you or anything, way we always like to do is, you know, like to talk about how you got into all of this wild, wacky world of metaphysics. Because, I mean, have you always been in this, or, you know, how did you start? Where did you come from?
Well, you
where know, start, Ron?
like most of us, apparently, I had sort of a conventional upbringing with conventional exposures, and I really only came to. I'm 60 now, so I'm 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, I came to the metaphysical world, and it was out of necessity. I'm a recovering alcoholic, and as classically happens to people with addiction problems, my life train wrecked. And I was forced to reject the conventional and start looking outside to find some other things that would make sense and work for me. And so that brought me into the recovery world, brought me into a variant form of therapeutic practices, spiritual teachers. And so for about, the actual count is about 31 years now, I've been exploring this. Had some real encouragement early on. The guidance I got was to seek wherever I needed to find what I needed, and that was permission to look everywhere. And so it's been a it's been a run through, more practices and approaches than I could probably recount here, but it's pretty varied at that point. And then, just to sort of at some point set us up here. And at some point I had to create my own understanding so that I could work my way through my life. And that became the way of spirit ultimately.
Well, I like what you said as far as, you know, how your life kind of train wrecked.
Yeah.
And so what were you doing previously? Just if I may ask.
Sure. Well, I was in the private sector. I actually had a pretty enviable job with a private sector corporation, a large corporation. I was in leadership. Mm-hmm. And I was following a pretty conventional life, you know, living the American dream, as they'd like to say it. And mm-hmm. and much to my surprise, the rug got pulled out from under me. It all started when my wife abandoned me, which got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned, and I'm sure you have this in your practice, is, you know, most of us seem to be walking through life with some degree of delusion about who we are, where we are, and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to many of us, and curiously, I just heard the data recently, very commonly around 28, 29 years old, the rug gets pulled out from under you. And all of a sudden, all the things you thought you knew become questionable. And so I think it's a very common story. And what happens is when those things you think you know fall away, many of us are forced to go look for something else that makes better sense or holds together better under duress. So I was in the private sector, and that eventually transitioned. I work for myself now doing a variety of things. I have a couple of companies, and don't seem to be able to work for anyone else anymore.
I understand that statement.
I the only boss I do well with is me.
Uh-huh. Totally get that one. Well, and like you said, I fully believe that, well, actually I've heard, you know, that, you know, here we're in this time of, they say, you know, awakening, where they, yeah, you know, to wake up. And that's kind of what you're saying. It's like you're saying about 30, you know, these things happen. But I think, but then we're also saying it's like in, I wonder if it's at that age or if it's this timeline in general. Humanity is waking up, and it just happens to be about the same, maybe it's coincidentally about the same time frame. But, you know, a lot of times that's just the way to get people's attention and get them to wake up is through things like this, is through train wrecks. I mean, that, because, like, you know, those things get your attention, and that's what makes you wake up. You know, you can't go through life sleeping anymore.
Well, and there are plenty who are saying, and I guess time will tell. I mean, you never know what tomorrow holds, but there are plenty who are saying that much of what's going up, the quickening of the culture, I heard it described, you know, the combination of travel and communication, the fact that we can get on our laptops and phones and whatever and have this kind of a conversation, the fact that things are speeding up, that technology is moving faster, is that there are those who say we are in the times of transformation. I know some believe that, you know, it's the apocalypse, but there's a lot of ancient prophecy that says that, you know, what looks like the apocalypse is actually the time of human transformation, and there's a lot of pressures on us. So I was just talking with somebody last night. I was doing a coaching session with someone, and we were talking about the perspective that you can either view this as of course train wreck or transformation, and they seem to be kind of the same space, don't they?
Absolutely. Exactly. I think it's just your perspective, like you said. Yeah. And it's just at first, it's, it just, you know, your world is falling apart. You're going, oh my God, what's going on? But then, like, I think it's just to get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just, okay, then what do you do with it?
Well, see, there's the magic question. What do you do with it? And I'll just say that my experience is I refer to all of this broadly as doing the work. Well, you know, that we take things inside and we do the work. And there's, of course, any number of practices. You know this from everything you've been involved in. Right. And the magic seems to be that rather than denying or jumping into any form of delusion or many, many culturally approved addictions. We do the work on these things, and that seems to be the magic elixir, that when we take them inside and work with them, they tend to become transformation rather than train wreck.
Right. So, okay, so you processed through all of that, so then you came out the other side, and now these things are happening. So where did the... When did the book come along, or when? So where was all that in your process?
Ah, well, let's see. So it took me about 10 years. So this would have been about 1995 mm-hmm. for me to really finally begin to look. I don't know, Julia, to look more deeply than I did. It sounds kind of ridiculous. I hadn't been able to look very deeply until about 1995. So I was about 10 years into my path. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point that I kind of had a rude awakening. I can't honestly tell you what exactly caused the rude awakening, but I had call it an epiphany. And the epiphany was that I was either going to have to go much more deeply or I just simply wasn't going to go anywhere. And it was so clear that I went to one of my spiritual teachers and I said, okay, let's do this deal. And he invited me into a practice that I'd never been exposed to at that point. But some people know Gurdjieff, George Gurdjieff, the Russian spiritualist, and he created a practice called the Fourth Way. Mm-hmm. And he basically took me very, very deeply into looking within in ways I'd never looked before. And frankly, what I found there was it enthralled me. And one of the most interesting things about it, which kind of creates a time warp effect, is what I discovered is I probably had the first calling. I probably had the first message trying to grab my attention when I was about 13. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out, I mean, it took me to almost 30 to start paying attention, but the first soundings were coming at about the age of 13, and then at about 40 years old or so, I was finally really primed for going much more deeply. And the entry point for that was the work of Gurdjieff in the Fourth Way, which sort of blew the doors off.
So what was happening at 13?
Well, you know, that's a very curious thing. All I know for sure that it was at about 13 that I suddenly began, I mean, you know, I'd been, like many of us, I'd been going to a regular kind of church, and this was in southeast Oklahoma. I grew up in McAllister, and it's about 2 hours south of Tulsa, more or less.
Yeah, that's just right over here.
Yeah, I'm just across a mountain range or two from you. Mm-hmm. And so... Actually, I knew the Ozarks by then because my parents honeymooned in the Ozarks.
Uh-huh. So did mine.
1952 or whatever. And so what happened was, as I began to open it up, I realized that there were things happening. I had an awakening experience through a Christian experience right about that time. There were a series of books that showed up in my life. Something was beginning to shift and be awakened in me, and I couldn't see it at the time, of course. In fact, that was at the point where I started drinking, right around 13, 14, and so that kind of allowed me to dampen the call, if you will, and ignore it for quite some time.
Okay.
It's not uncommon when I talk with people who come into the metaphysical or mystical world for them to say something like they knew at a relatively early age that there was something calling to them or something nudging them. The people who follow Gurdjieff call it magnetic center, that there's something inside that is awakening, and it begins to call to us. And apparently, apparently it takes a little while for us to hear the call. And in my case, that really took until I was... in my early 40s, when I was finally ready to go much more deeply.
Mm-hmm. Why does he? I just wonder what it is about us. I mean, like in your case, like you said, you were dampening, mm-hmm. and I've heard of that too. That, you know, it's like people will hear things and or hear the call or things, and then they'll do things that will maybe to I guess, is it a denial? Do you not, is it something to, what is it? What is it you're doing? I mean, what is you know what I'm trying to say, don't you?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. One is the culture, the larger, well, for most of us, it's the culture that whatever culture we're in, which is, it's enculturating us. Mm-hmm. And so whatever we're being enculturated into is trying to tell us there's a certain way things are. And of course, that calling, you know, the way of the spirit, you know, the mystical, whatever we want to call it, it doesn't know any boundaries. You know, if there's one thing about those who have gone deeply into the mystical or metaphysical path, they essentially start to cross boundaries. In fact, they sometimes create their own path. And so it's almost like all the pressure. So you're like 12, 13, 10, 14, whatever. You're doing everything you can to figure it out, right? Figure life out. Mm-hmm. And everything in the culture is basically saying, no, just get your grades up. Nope, just go to church. Nope, just, I mean, whatever, you know, enculturation you're in. And at that point, we're just not our souls aren't yet strong enough to be able to go off on our own path. There's a certain amount of maturation, I think, that is required. And of course, not surprisingly, at the age of 13 or 14, most of us are very interested in the things of the world, aren't we? I mean, there's those things that start happening to bodies and, you know, the opposite sex or the same, if you're not hetero, you know, they start look really appealing and, you know, opportunities in the world, social opportunities. And, there's a whole lot of distractions. Interestingly enough, what the followers of the Fourth Way, Gurdjieff's work, say is that in order to do the deep work later, you have to form a strong personality first. That the strong personality that is formed up until, let's say, the age of 30 becomes the fuel, is their exact word. It becomes the fuel for your transformation. And so it's almost as if we need to really form that strong identity in the world in order to move beyond the world. And of course, I just want to admit this because someone will always ask this question. And Julia, there are always people who are exceptions to this. I mean, the Dalai Lama was not tracking a conventional track at the age of 14. And knowing your mother fairly well, I'm pretty sure you weren't on a conventional track at 14 either. And so what we're exposed to has a huge influence on how and where we're willing to go with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, I mean, you know, it may not have been a conventional track, but I still, you know, I was in church and I was, you know, you still have that thing, those structures around you.
Because
I'm sitting here thinking, well, when and what happened when, you know, so, yeah. Well,
one of the things, and this actually comes up, my master's is in social work and, which I got after, you know, the train wreck. And they talk about creating a psychobiography, and what they mean by that is that if you really want to do this, it's actually an intriguing exploration. You can go back and look for the sentinel events developmentally, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, that happened that created, you know, the Julia Cannon who is today. And you can actually go back, and I mean, some of this is regression work, which I know you know lots and lots about. Where you can go back and you can actually identify the markers along the way that created the being that you are today. And of course, lots of them are not pleasant markers. They aren't positive experiences, but they form the way we see and experience the world. So when you say, I wonder what happened, it's like, well, I mean, you should get some of your practitioners to regress you and go figure that out, Julia.
Yeah, but like you're saying, you know, as far as like those teenage years and it's like, because, you know, we all have those things, but yeah, granted mine may have been a little bit different, but it was still a lot the same too, because I think there's a lot of that structure is very similar, but yeah. Cause I was really shy back then.
But, oh, well, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, developmentally and brain development now, again, this is sort of in the social work space that I work some in. you know, we now know that a lot of the important brain formation clicks in around the ages of 17, 18 years old, and then again around 25 or 26, mm-hmm. which is why so often you hear parents talk about how their kids suddenly at those ages suddenly, you know, took a giant step forward in terms of their maturity. And so whatever's going on at 15 or 16 preceded some of those really big formations of the cerebral cortex of the brain. And so who knows what was going on then, but I'm sure it was interesting.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is really, I always love things like this, you know, figuring how people became who they were.
Yeah. Well, sure. And mm-hmm. I'm going to go right back into regression work now, whether it's, you know, hypnosis as regression, or I did some past life regression at one point and I've done breath work as regression, mm-hmm. is the ability to go back and tap those. I mean, the basic notion that everything is there to be discovered. We've just, we've forgotten it, as it were. Right. And so to be able to go back and tap those things to really see how we've been formed. And then, of course, there are many practitioners who will go beyond the time-space continuum and will, I mean, they'll go back into a past life or they'll go, you know, well beyond that into other forms, mm-hmm. and bring back information that helps inform us to things that are or were or could be. And as best I can tell from listening to them, it's pretty unbounded. There don't seem to be limits where one can go with regressive practices.
Oh, exactly. You can go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's just keep progressing. So you're, okay. Yeah, let's just keep going.
Sure. So along the way, I had a series of, so the Gurdjieff piece was really central. So too was a practice known as A Course in Miracles. Which was, a fairly spiritual orientation, scripturally based, but heretical by the standards of most conventional Christian thought. I also dove fairly deeply into Eastern mysticism via Zen and ultimately through Buddhism. And so those, they certainly weren't diversions. They were ways of understanding more deeply what I have referred to as the way of spirit. Which we can learn from all kinds of places. In the end, I gained a tremendous well of information from ancient Tibetan practice. Mm. And I didn't come to that through the usual manner. One of my spiritual teachers encouraged me to become a hospice volunteer, to work with people who are dying.
Right.
And the reason he didn't suggest it out of virtue. He suggested I do it because he said I was so self-centered that I needed to go someplace where I could work on behalf of something that self-centeredness had no place in. And frankly, dying people have no business other than that business. And so I spent several years in death and dying practice and tripped across some ancient Tibetan practices that had proved to be very, very valuable. And also found a guy by the name of Stephen Levine, who was some people who say he's a fairly conventional Buddhist, but he went places with death and dying work that nobody else had. And the combined effect of that was that I started, and this is where the breath work practice, breathing, releasing, breaking through came from, was they began to talk about how much of what we need to know is in the body, not in the thought. That Western culture is very obsessed with thoughts, and that there's actually a rich body of knowledge around what happens in the body, that our body, our registers, that they're always receiving information and holding information and telling things to us, but we don't listen well. And so it's broadly referred to as somatic practice. And what ended up happening, Julie, and the part that was personal in this was my continued debugging process. So this was all going on 10 to 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. In order to get at the things that I needed to see about myself and about my history and about cleaning up my affairs, I couldn't get at it cognitively. And so the combination of a practice known as EMDR, breath work, some of this ancient Tibetan practice essentially allowed me to bypass the intellect, cognition, and go find the experience in the body, which, by the way, is what they do to heal trauma. In okay. some ways, it reminded me of shamanic practice, you know, the whole notion of soul retrieval or re-embodiment, which is to go back and pick up these pieces of us that have been lost and re-embody ourselves. And so what awakened in me was a physical in the body knowingness that is now a complement to what it is to know in the head. I mean, some people say you can know in the head and you can know in the heart, and both are valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put together breathing, you probably remember this story, the way that particular CD set that you all put together for me, that audio set, was because I was doing a workshop. I was doing a healing and forgiveness workshop, and somebody came up. We were doing breath work and some other somatic practice, some movement practice, chakra work. And somebody came up and said, "Where can I buy your CD set?" And I said to myself, "Well, hell, I need a CD set." And that's when I called you all and said, "You want to do a CD set?" And you all fortunately said yes. So what I learned was that somatic practice that takes us back. And I mean, I don't know if you all use this in your regression practices, but so much of regression is cognitive regression. But when you start doing regressive practices and start looking for things in the body, it opens up another piece of the knowing that we just can't tap cognitively because it's not in cognition, it's in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Which all probably sounds like mumbo jumbo, but...
No, not at all.
It's like, and I guess the reason I just said that is because there's such a cultural agreement that we know in our heads and that's it. And the knowingness is, I mean, it permeates the whole body as best I can tell.
Right. But, you know, there may be some people, I mean, I get it, but there may be some out there that this is an odd idea to them. So why don't you give some examples of what you mean by that?
Great. All right. So we'll go with some of the more dramatic stuff because it's easier to see.
Mm-hmm.
I did some work with a woman who had had a traumatic experience. She was assaulted and raped.
Okay.
And she had, what typically is referred to as an out-of-body experience. She literally was watching the violent act being perpetrated mm-hmm. on her from outside her body.
Mm-hmm.
When she did somatic practice, we used some breath work and some light regression work. What she could literally recall, and she'd never been able to do this with therapeutic work, what she was literally able to recall was the feeling of being suffocated by the experience. I mean, mm-hmm. literally a feeling. And now she wasn't being strangled or anything like that, but she could feel the suffocating effect in the body. And when she began to breathe into that, it would have been right through the core. I mean, essentially the fear centers starting from just above the top of the pit of the belly, up underneath the breastbone, the place a lot of people feel anxiety.
Right.
She could literally feel the suffocating effect. And as she began to breathe into and through that, it began to open up and release. And the only way to describe what happened for her was it wasn't as if memories were recovered. But what happened was the experience itself that she had, because it was so painful to her, she had divorced herself from that.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was she remembered the feeling, which of course was very painful, a lot of tears. And as she continued to breathe through it, the feelings in the core began to soften and release. And so last time I spoke with her, I guess it's been some months now, she continues to have to use breath work. And she actually picked up EFT, emotional freedom technique, tapping techniques
mm-hmm.
that she also uses, which are a somatic practice, to continue to manage that feeling because it was deeply traumatizing. So literally, a piece of that experience was stored in the body as what we might call trauma in the core. And so she went and she fetched it up there.
Go ahead. Well, in way, was she having like physical symptoms? Was she having issues? from this?
Well, not so much physical. She and I were talking because her relationship history was pretty damaged.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she was, and of course, I mean, take someone traumatized them badly enough, it really does interfere with the ability to relate appropriately. And so we were working on this because of her challenges with relationships.
Right.
And of course, if you go at that cognitively, you talk about relationships and how you think about others, and there's all kinds of tools and tips and techniques. And I mean, that's all great. I don't mean to diminish anything. But Julia, the place she was blocked off was not in her thoughts. It was physically in the body from a trauma that happened when she was a young woman.
Well, and the area that you're describing would really be close. It'd be like the heart chakra area.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's what she had to, you know, and that's where she was suffocated through, and then that's what she has to, I mean, that makes sense.
It's
the relationship zone.
It also explains why sometimes you'll hear people talk about the relief they get from some yoga postures that open the heart chakra.
Because
you're encouraged to open the heart chakra, you know, pull the shoulders back.
Right.
Cobra. There's a couple of those that are real powerful chakra opening. I'm no yoga expert. I know just enough to know a piece of it. But and then they'll be encouraged to breathe and hold the posture.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not thinking about what you're feeling there. What you're literally doing is breathing in and releasing the physicality of what's there. And they would say, well, you're opening the chakra. The Buddhists have a wonderful phrase that I like, where they refer to broken open heartedness. We're busting that open.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Levine, I mentioned him earlier, wrote a book called Unattended Sorrow, where he said that what's happening is our hearts have become calloused.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing with these practices is we're breaking through the calluses to release the true nature of the heart. That's my words for what he said. But so that's a rather graphic experience. I was doing a meditation workshop one day, and I don't know, we had 60 or 70 people there, and one woman asked whether or not we could use somatic practice to deal with a pain she'd been having in her hip. And I said, well, hell, I don't know. Let's try. So, I like to pretend like I understand a lot of it, but the truth of the matter is we don't exactly know how things happen. So anyway, we did some breath practices. And there was this really, really interesting point where literally the look on her face changed. And I asked her what had happened, because we'd been doing a series of breathing. These were mostly breath work, working with that hip.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point she shifted and she started breathing, and we still don't know the connection. She started breathing into the pit of her belly. And the look on her face was that the pain in her hip that had been there for a while just literally vanished. And she said, well, what happened? And I said, well, I mean, I don't know what happened, but the pain's gone, right? So I don't pretend to understand that one, but that was something was literally physically held in the body.
Right.
And I don't know why breathing into the stomach released it, but it was a really good example of how there was something there with some attending to, as Stephen Levine would have said. That it got attended to and it released, and so that's the physical side, which is in many ways just like, I mean, when you do regressive practices of all kinds, they essentially go back into cognition and history and beyond history and all that. So apparently it works in the physical realm just as well. Does that seem to make better sense?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the book that I have, The Soul Speaks the Language of Your Body, and that's where it's talking about. It's all the messages of the body, and
right.
and as well as its energy blockages in the body and things like that. And it's just their messages just trying to get through. It's exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's just a matter of understanding. So these are all just different ways that we have of communicating,
mm-hmm.
Understanding what our bodies are trying to tell us. And so this is just another wonderful way of getting to that and helping it release and understand it, what it is. You know, so this is, I totally get it. It's wonderful.
Well, I thought you probably would. And just to put an interesting little spin on this, I was having a conversation last week with somebody who comes out of a principally an evangelical Christian orientation. Mm-hmm. And I don't often get to speak with folks of that type. They have some challenges with some of what we're talking about. Let's just say that.
Okay.
And anyway, by the time we were done talking it through, it was such an interesting conversation for me, because what she was able to identify was there were some places in the body that she said, Ron, I've always said that's where the Holy Spirit speaks to me. And I thought, well, how about that? So she, I mean, I wouldn't have expected to hear that in the churches I grew up in, but.
Exactly.
She had clearly associated her evangelical practice with literally feeling it in the body. And I thought, well, of course, I mean, that makes perfectly good sense. I mean, if our form of reference to that is in that case, a Holy Spirit perspective, then, I mean, sure, that's fine. That makes sense to me as well. I just hadn't been expecting it from that direction.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So, this latest, I mean, you kind of alluded to that, but you've been doing the breath work, and then now you've got the Spirit. That's
the Holy Spirit. Well, you know, the starting point for this was about 15 years ago. And at that point in time, I was in a variety of conversations where people were talking about, you know, Spirit is everything, or God is everything, or there's only life, capital L. And of course, I started hearing people saying things like, what we hear today is, it's like, it's all good. Right now, most of us don't actually believe that, but we say it a lot. The reason I said that is because we typically don't really say that when something's particularly painful. We don't look at the painful stuff, go, oh, that's probably good. We really want to be done with it. But anyway, what happened, Julia, was I said, so wait a minute. If what we're hearing is that this force, this power, this God, this Holy Spirit, whatever label people are comfortable with, if it's ever present, then what's going on here? I mean, that doesn't make any sense that we would talk about the ever presence of the Spirit, or that we would talk about that life force is ever present. Or again, I use lots of language around this because I'm not so much hung up on how we label it, but I said, well, this doesn't make any sense. So it started a several year exploration of trying to explain how it could be that if Spirit is embodying everything, mm-hmm. then there must be a different way to look at these things. And I drew from a number of sources and a number of teachers, a couple of really good psychologists as well. I had to hammer my way through it, because what I had to start doing was looking around me and saying, okay, if Spirit is everything, if it truly is all good, if that's true, somehow or another, it's all divine manifestation or creative manifestation, then there must be something that's going on here that I don't understand. And so as I drew from all those sources and started testing, what I would literally do is I would look at something and say, okay, train wreck. All right, how's a train wreck a perfect manifestation of Spirit? Or you would hear some horrific story about some heinous behavior. Right. And I would say, okay, all right, if this Spirit is everything thing is true, then that somehow must be a perfect manifestation. It must be. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we're all lying to ourselves. And if that's true, that's okay too, I guess. But so what ended up happening was I started trying to go in and look at how Spirit flows. And so the way of Spirit is essentially looking at the starting proposition is it must all be spiritual energy. And then I did a little bit of a play with my research on Einstein's famous formula about energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, which would propose that, you know, even physical form is just compressed energy. So there's only energy. And energy always flows. That's the nature of energy. It's always moving. It's always going somewhere, even if we can't see it. Even the desktop that's right in front of me here, it's actually moving. We just can't sense it because the movement is so minute. Right. So if energy is always flowing, then there's only energy flowing in directions that it's being moved to, pointed to, co-opted by. And so then what I started doing was taking these and saying, okay, so how would, for example, how would our psychology take spiritual energy? And the starting point for this was I was working with a guy who, big guy, not fat, just big guy, the kind of guy you look at and say, wow, he could probably take care of himself.
Okay.
But he'd grown up in Texas and, played football and all that stuff. But what we had discovered were there was a part of him that was just very frightened. And of course you can't talk about that because you're a big guy and all that. But anyway, there was a part of him that was fearful and we were doing this work. And so what it turned out was he'd had some pretty abusive practices when he was a child, when he was very small. And basically the way he would say it today, if he were on here, is he would say, it was beat into me to fear.
Okay.
Literally. Beaten into him to fear. So he's walking the world with this deep psychic belief that it is appropriate to fear and fear everything. Now, wow. That's deeply held in the body. It's literally beaten into the body. And you can't talk a person out of that.
No.
I mean, it's not in their active thought. I mean, literally, it's been beaten into them. So, mm-hmm. So in addition to playing, you know, doing breath work with this guy. So what happened was we would get these glimpses of release, and all of a sudden he would literally have an emotional reset. The fear would just vanish. And so what we played with as we worked out the way of spirit was, as long as in his heart of hearts he believed he was unsafe, spirit supplied all the energy to be frightened. As soon as that shifted and he didn't in his heart of hearts, when he believed it was safe, suddenly spirit would move towards him feeling safe in the world. That literally spirit was spiritual energy in the form of emotion, perspective, and everything was being co-opted by what he believed to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So now all of a sudden, all that stuff that they talk about in things like The Secret and, you know, the Law of Attraction and all of those begins to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Is that literally, you know, the energy we are carrying with us based on how what we believe deep within us to be most true is co-opting spiritual energy. So now when someone is, when you take a big strapping guy who's acting frightened, now all of a sudden you don't say there's something wrong. You say, oh, spirit is flowing based on how he's perceiving. Let's work with his perception. So the fear is a perfect spiritual manifestation in that case. Because if he really was at risk, he should be frightened, but he's not. So then you begin to play with all of this and look at how we co-opt spiritual energy and misdirect it. And usually at this point, someone will ask me something about some heinous character in history. Well, Ron, are you saying that, you know, Hitler's behavior is spiritual energy, spiritual expression, that God did that? And I am kind of pointing in that direction that says that if in our heart of hearts, as it were, we see a certain way, that spiritual energy flows everywhere, and it doesn't seem to have an opinion. So I'm going to stop right there and see if that is making some sense. It's kind of an esoteric idea, but
absolutely. That's they've compared it. It's like electricity.
Yes.
It's neutral. I mean, it's going to, it just flows, you know, and it's, you're the one that makes it whatever way it is.
And
if that's an accurate way of saying, I mean, it's a very simplistic way of saying it, but there's probably a better way. I'm sure you have a better way of saying it, but it's like, it's just going to go. It's just flowing.
Right. And so what happens with that, the beauty of this and the beauty of my practice now with all the things I do, is if it's true that energy is just flowing where it needs to flow based on the prevailing time, place, and circumstance, then the only question to ask, I mean, there's no point in judging it. I mean, it doesn't mean we shouldn't take action. If something problematic is happening, we should intervene. But it means that we can drop our judgment and substitute curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
We can now look at it and say, okay, let's just say hypothetically that, you know, Julia, you're doing something that looks kind of crazy to me. I shouldn't even use that word because that's condemnatory, but you're doing something that doesn't seem to add up. So now what happens with a way of spirit perspective is now I look at it and I say, huh, well, I wonder what in the world is going on inside of her that would cause her to act that way. Now I'm in inquiry mode rather than judgment mode. And Brené Brown, who everybody just rants and raves about these days, Brené Brown's done some great work. I'm sure many of the listeners have heard of her. You know, Brené Brown said this most profound thing in one of her, I think it was one of her TED Talks or one of her podcasts, I can't remember which. Anyway, Brené Brown said, as soon as we blame, our inquiry ceases. So as soon as if you were doing something I didn't understand, as soon as I label you crazy, which is essentially a blame statement, my inquiry stops, and therefore there's no growth possible. So as soon as we open up curiosity and inquiry, as soon as we look with the way of spirit in mind and become curious, and again, it may require action. If you're getting ready to hurt yourself, Julia, I may have to intervene. I'm not talking about not taking action.
Right.
I'm talking about seeking understanding, because if it's true that all spiritual energy is just simply moving where it needs to go based on prevailing time, place, and circumstance, beliefs, etc., then what I need is understanding, not judgment. And when I act out of understanding, my effectiveness goes up much, much higher. It makes it possible for me to be far more effective in the world, which matters a lot.
Mm-hmm. Another simplistic, I break it all down, simplistic, the way I've heard it, is like they've said, it's like you're the a captain and you have the crew.
Yep.
And it's like, you know, whatever you say, you know, the crew is ready to give you whatever you want.
Right.
And so it's kind of the same thing. Would that be another simplistic way of saying that?
It's
like
what
you put out there. It's like they're going, okay, aye, aye, Captain. You know?
Yeah. It just spiritual energy goes where it's supposed to. One of the ones that's been intriguing, I'm sure you have done some work in this area, you know, the whole prosperity work, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Where there's a whole lot of people who are having poverty problems of various kinds, and they decide to do prosperity work. Well, one of my teachers, a guy by the name of Joel Goldsmith, says the only person who affirms that they're prosperous are people who believe that they're in poverty. And he's right. And so I know a lot of people who are doing prosperity work with no apparent success. Well, that's because you can't just affirm your way into prosperity. You have to do the poverty work, right? I mean, if I were doing regression work on someone with a prosperity problem or a poverty problem, I would go looking at what the sources of their poverty perceptions were. Because until we illuminate the poverty perceptions, we can't bring something new into the equation. We're stuck with the old perspective, and we have to go illuminate the old perspective if we're going to get movement, which is why for far too many people, prosperity affirmations don't seem to work very well ultimately. They make them feel good, but way too many people don't seem to have any success with them.
Yeah, in other words, what you're saying, you have to see where that's coming from.
Yes, that's a good, yes, very, yes. Sometimes.
Where is that, you know, is it beliefs, thoughts, you know, what? Where is it coming from? And then once you establish that and correct it, whatever, then you can go forward. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. And that's, I mean, it's the purpose of a lot of these practices, and much regressive practice, much hypnotic practice, much a lot of therapy. I mean, a whole lot of things are trying to go at this. So too with a lot of spiritual practice. I don't remember how long ago it was, but someone helped me see that even when Jesus talked about how you can't put new wine into old wineskins, it's the same thing. What he's telling us, you can't get something new without dealing with the old container, because the old container will spoil the new, because you can't make room for something new without letting go of the old. And yet all of a sudden we're in the Gospels, right?
I love it. I love that. I mean, because that's a whole new way of looking at it. I never thought of it that way.
I was blown away as soon as it began. It's like, well, of course that makes sense. Yeah. And so the challenge in this, and the Jungians, I have spent a fair time messing around in Carl Jung's space, and the Jungians talk about how you don't reach enlightenment by imagining figures of light, but by illuminating the darkness.
Exactly.
And so that whole body of work, the shadow work, as a friend of mine recently called it, that's what the shadow work is. But none of us wants to go there, Julia. We want to go look at we want to do the stuff that feels good. We don't want to go look at the stuff that's ugly and dark and painful and unpleasant.
Yeah, we don't like the muck and the mire.
That's right. We don't. It's like, I don't want to deal with the muck. Well, you're going to be stuck in the swamp till you get done with the muck. So let's go look at the muck.
Yeah. I mean, that's where the stuff is over in that muck and the mire.
What I really like about a way of viewing this is, yeah, we're going to have to go look at the muck, and it's useful to keep your eyes on the light.
Absolutely.
We're not talking about staying in darkness all the while. We're talking about going to the darkness and remembering the light. That it seems like we have to do both, but we can't get there by just looking at the light, because we're up to our ankles in muck.
That's the truth. Ron, before we run out of time, we've got about 3 minutes left. Can you tell everybody how they can find you if they'd like to contact you?
Sure. I have two websites that are useful. One is ronaldchapman.com, which is where you kind of find connectors to all the things I'm doing. If you're looking for content, you can go to seeingtrue.com. Which is where I blog and provide video content, and it's all free. So, but both of those sites will point you to the books, and certainly to, you know, the Way of Spirit, which Ozark Mountain, you know, put out this year. So,
okay, super, fantastic. Okay, so we still have a couple of minutes, so we'll go ahead. And anything else you want to share?
Well, you know, yeah, I want to just say this. A lot of this sounds pretty dire and difficult and all of that. And what I just want to share is that the one thing I've seen over and over again is, even though it sounds laborious and difficult and the muck isn't pleasant, apparently this is the work we're here to do. And it's really worthwhile. It just doesn't always feel so good. So I want to acknowledge it doesn't always feel so good, but it's oh so valuable, and encourage people to see what they can do to find their way into their own healing spaces.
Well, because then it does feel good, doesn't it, after that?
Yes, it does, until you reach the next round of muck, and then, it's like, oh no, I'm going to do this again. It's like, well, yeah, that seems to be the nature of it too.
But that's growth.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody told me that part of our mischief, our human mischief, is we think that enlightenment or awakening or nirvana or heaven, we think that is a place we arrive. And they told me, this is one of my teachers, said, perhaps it's actually an active state that's being managed moment to moment, that we're constantly refining heaven or nirvana or enlightenment. And that it just requires us to keep doing this active, making these active practices for that to be possible.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I do too.
Yeah. I think we'll make that. That's the final right there. I think, I love it. So, Yes. Well, thank you, Ron, so much for being here. This has been wonderful, and it's gone by. We're done. I mean, yeah. Our time is up.
Well, I'm glad we got the technology fixed. Otherwise, we wouldn't.
Oh, me too. Yes. but thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
It has been wonderful. Okay. And everyone, thank you for being with us. And I'll see you next week. And happy December. And enjoy your week wherever you are. And I love you all. And we'll be back. And just everyone have a wonderful week. Bye-bye. Yeah.